Welcome back to the Tale of Two Cities podcast. What up, Richmond? What up, Oakland? I'm Ryan Lindsay.
And I'm Rachel Lloyd, and we'll be your host this week. This episode is all about history.
History indeed. We're going to learn about an old musical instrument that finds a new owner.
Donating it, I was like thrilled and like so excited that it was going to be going somewhere useful and not just sitting in my room collecting dust.
We'll also hear about Oakland Unified School District's annual Martin Luther King Jr. Oratorical Festival.
He walks this young woman. She has something already picked out, and I hear it, and I'm like, wow, what made you pick that piece?
We'll hear about the last remaining Rosie the Riveters in Richmond who worked on the city's shipyards during World War II.
It wasn't easy work, but I was so happy to do it because I'd been wanting to do something to help our boys.
And finally, we'll hear about how the Richmond Museum is celebrating 100 years of World War I history. That's all coming up on the Tales of Two Cities podcast.
So a lot of us have probably bought things from thrift stores or been given hand-me-downs, but I don't think we really stop to think about where that item's been before it came to us and what kind of stories it might have to tell. Rosa Furneaux and Brian Kranz followed a very special object from coast to coast and across the bay to find out what happens when something old becomes something new.
I kind of love the subtle power of the flute. It, you know, it's an instrument that people think of as being very delicate, and it can be.
Veronika Dolginko has played the flute since she was 5 years old. Her instrument has taken her through a childhood of school ensembles and state competitions, and into an adulthood informed by a love of music. Until recently, she'd been playing the same flute, but finally the time had come to move on.
It was definitely starting to, you know, it had some repairs, you know, even while I had it, and then it was starting to kind of fall apart here and there.
The old flute was still working, but when her new one arrived, she began to wonder what to do with the instrument.
And I was talking to my parents about it, and they're both, my dad's actually not musical, but he wishes he was, and my mom's very musical. And she had said, like, you should probably donate it.
So the flute began its next journey. From the secondhand store to Veronica's childhood home on Long Island, it had traveled across the country to California. Now she took it downtown to an office at the heart of San Francisco. Barry Wolfbone is the general manager in music in schools today. Known as MUST, they run a preschool music literacy session, an after-school enrichment program, and even musical petting zoos. They also run an instrument drive to collect gently used instruments for schools that would otherwise go without. Barry met Veronica the day she dropped off her flute.
I could see in her face she was getting a little emotional, and I was like, do you still play? And she was like, I do, that's why I'm donating the flute, because I got a new flute. And I've had this one for over 20 years.
Last year, MUST received between 500 and 600 instruments worth $50,000.
Trumpet, clarinet, flute. This one just came in today. It's a really nice, little baby horn.
All of those instruments will go to Bay Area schools where 65% or more students qualify as low income.
Most of the time, if the school wasn't receiving instruments from us, it would mean that they wouldn't have a music program. We've had schools that have come to us with nothing and have been able to start or restart a lapsed music program. We've had schools that have grown their programs because of the instruments they've received.
Giving up the flute was bittersweet for Veronica.
Donating it, I was like thrilled and like so excited that it was going to be going somewhere useful and not just sitting in my room collecting dust. But it is this moment of like, all right, I'm giving something up. But, you know, you're letting go of something that you've had for so long. Just being like, oh, all right, go out there, go and make someone else happy.
The flute waited in Barry's office until its next owner came calling. Meanwhile, in Oakland, a middle school band was busy practicing.
Bob Dudak needs to be bigger.
My name is Zach Pittsmith, and I teach music at Edna Brewer Middle School, which is a public middle school in Oakland. Our music program has grown from when I started here 10 years ago from a good, you know, the first band I had 17 kids in it, and now there are a good third of the school in the program. And so that's over 200 kids, and we've had to accrue the instruments.
Funding the program isn't always easy, but Zach says it's vital.
Standardized tests don't meet everything of the child. What about their soul? What about their heart? What about their engagement with community? What about their ability to express themselves?
But reeds, repairs, and instruments don't come cheap. Zach actually got his start teaching music in the Bay Area with MUST 15 years ago, and now the organization is helping Edna Brewer.
We've been recipient and even the drop-off place for a couple years now, and they've really helped us, you know, build our inventory of our instruments here.
Oakland School District receives the largest number of instruments from MUST. Barry remembers meeting Zach after last year's instrument drive.
And when I got there, the band teacher came out and he said, okay, what's for me? And I opened the trunk and I said, everything that's back here. And he said, are you serious? I said, yes. So he goes in, comes back out. All these kids run out and they said, are those for us? And I was like, yes. And they were like, yes. And they all started reaching in and grabbing the instruments and they were so excited. That was the best day since I've been working here.
Now, almost every Edna Brewer student has their own instrument. Zach says this is important because students can take their instruments home to practice. Today, there's another special delivery.
My name is Camelia Illigan. I'm 12 years old and I go to Edna Brewer Middle School.
Camelia plays the ukulele, the piano, and the flute.
Well, I chose the flute mainly because it was a concert-pitched instrument, so I thought it would be easier so I couldn't transpose.
Camelia's just become the flute's new owner.
Oh, I actually just got it today. It's a little different because, like, I think, the buttons are, thinner, I guess. I guess it'll help me more because since this is, a school flute that I have, I have to bring it back for summer and I wouldn't be able to practice. But since now I have my own, I get to do whatever I want with it.
Veronica remembers how the flute gave her that kind of freedom, too.
It just fit so perfectly in my hand and it was just so easy to carry around and it just, anytime I wanted to play it, I could play it. It was just there. I grew up in the middle of the woods, and I'd, go out into the woods and play my flute, a magical creature from whatever.
Camelia doesn't live near any woods, but the flute is magical for her in a different way. She's pretty shy, but recently...
So, during practice, we, Mr. Fitzsmith asked people if they wanted a solo. I thought at first it was just for fun, I guess. But then my friend Cindy kept telling me to volunteer because she says I'm so shy and awkward. So I guess I ended up doing it at the concert.
When she played at the concert, she didn't sound at all shy and awkward. She brought the house down.
From the woods of Long Island to the streets of Oakland, the flute has found its new home. And for another young musician, the adventure is just beginning.
Perfect.
Yeah.
That was amazing. Thank you so much, you two.
For the Tale of Two Cities podcast with my colleague Brian Kranz, I'm Rosa Furno.
In our next piece, Ryan and I captured an OUSD tradition. The annual Martin Luther King Jr. Oratorical Festival has been around for nearly four decades. The event brings students from all over Oakland to the stage, performing a mix of poems, speeches, and dramatic scenes. Here's more.
So, Dylann Roof, Tupac, Nancy DeVos, and Nina Simone walk into a bar. Imagine that bar is actually a stage at Castlemont High School. And on that stage are students, from pre-K to 12th grade, performing poems, speeches, and dramatic scenes.
It was rumored that we were soft. Had cumulus cloud elapsed, a man could lay his troubles upon.
Hey, black child, be what you can be. Learn what you must learn. Do what you can do.
Welcome to the 38th Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Oratorical Festival, an annual competition hosted by the Oakland Unified School District to celebrate and honor the civil rights leader. Students start working on their pieces in late fall. In January, they participate in a district-wide competition. Then, in February, those who advance compete in the finals. Some students, like Lovely Lachey Hudson, a second grader from Carl B. Monk Elementary School who writes her own poetry, are coached by their parents. Here's Lovely's dad, Anthony Hudson.
I have her drop of a hat. She do it. We was at Starbucks. I was talking to somebody. I said, Lovely, perform. Then we was at Durant somewhere. Lovely perform at the barbershop. At the drop of a hat, she has to perform. I know what she can do when we around each other, but I want the world and other people to know her capabilities and her talents.
I think it's awesome, and I hope the kids that want to do it can do it, and don't be shy.
Lovely stood in a yellow dashiki print skirt before the crowd of over 300 people to perform her original poem.
Who says black is not beautiful? Have you seen Michelle Obama and her mocha chocolate skin? Black is radiance that illuminates from within.
Other students, like Skylyn freshman Eleanor Wickstrom, are coached by a faculty member at their school. Eleanor recited poet Denise Froman's The Hour Dylann Roof Sat in the Church, a poem that questions the mass murderer who sat through a prayer meeting before killing 9 members of Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, South Carolina, on June 17, 2015.
A church that's cleaned more blood off the walls than you have ever fantasized of. That is to say, you're not the first white boy to feel small and create chaos in someone else's home.
Eleanor's faculty member happened to be Owele Makiba, the festival's director and Skyline's drama department director.
In walks this young woman. She has something already picked out, and I hear it. And I'm like, wow, what made you pick that piece? Where did you find that? You know, how are you even aware of it? She talks about stumbling across it and how it captures what she felt in her own gut or heart about the tragic situation that happened in South Carolina.
The festival was founded in 1978 by Donald Oliver, a former principal who passed away in 2010. Oliver felt that standardized testing did not highlight students' comprehension and literacy skills in ways that allowed them to relate to texts emotionally and challenge them to dig deeper than a multiple choice question.
His focus was on how do I create an oration, an academic exercise, so that students are reading the complex texts, that they're analyzing, they're synthesizing, they're interpreting, they're critiquing, and then presenting that back in a performance as text, a new form, which now they're competing in public speaking.
Makiba says that some schools have budgets to hire coaches, but not every school has that luxury. 3 years ago, the festival almost didn't happen. In 2014, she says, Lisa Spillman, an OUSD official, noticed that after almost 4 decades, the festival didn't have a line item on the school district's annual budget.
Lisa made a very compassionate talk or speech at a board meeting about the importance of the oratorical and its history to the new school board and new superintendent at the time, Antoine Wilson and his team. And then I got a call and said, you know, would you be available to work as the producer of it? Because if not, we may lose it.
At the time, Makiba was working in central office as a literacy coach. She said yes.
Take the stage, please. Atlantis Clay, Skyline High School, an open letter to Betsy DeVos.
So I suppose we also need to bring up the elephant in the room. We're a little freaked out by your nomination to be Secretary of Education. You aren't an educator.
Chris Chapman, the school district's newly appointed director of equity, was introduced to the festival as a parent when his 2 sons began competing a few years ago. Chapman was one of 5 judges at the February 26th finals.
One of the most scariest things in life is public speaking, and the fact that we had all these children today have the audacity to stand in, you know, in front of several hundred people. All of them should get an award. All of them should be acknowledged. All of them should be celebrated. So from a judge standpoint, having to kind of rate or rank is always difficult because really they should all be walking away with trophies. My heart says all of y'all attends, you know?
I'm in pain because the world I'm growing up in is cracking and crumbling before my very eyes, and I could blame it all on Trump. But the truth is ours was a fractured America before he further exposed the cracks.
Sem Getsachu, a freshman at Oakland Tech, says he used to hate when his mother forced him to do the festival while he was in elementary school. A few years later, he started writing poetry and realized the power in sharing his words on a stage.
No one is too small or too irrelevant to speak up for what they believe in, and that
you don't have to, you know, you don't have to be a poet. You don't have to be someone who thinks of themselves as a public speaker to be able to go up on a stage and share your story.
For Oakland North, I'm Ryan Lindsay. So everybody knows about the Lady in Red, the red bandana. I'm talking about the iconic Rosie the Riveter. But what was a day in the life like for a Rosie? Lizzie Roberts visited the Rosie the Riveter Education Center in Richmond and spoke to some of the last remaining Rosies about life in those shipyards during World War II.
Agnes Moore is 97 years old and still drives a Porsche. But over 70 years ago, she was a welder in Richmond shipyards during World War II. She was a Rosie. Tens of thousands of women worked in the shipyards doing jobs like draftsmanship and riveting. The name Rosies is short for Rosie the Riveter, an icon depicted through wartime posters, advertisements, and songs featuring female workers.
It wasn't easy work, but I was so happy to do it because I'd been wanting to do something to help our boys.
Moore is one of half a dozen Rosies who take part in a storytelling event and meet and greet every Friday at the Rosie the Riveter Trust Visitor Center in Richmond's historic shipyards. During the war, an average day for Moore involved welding deep inside a ship's hull.
And the sparks fly all over. You have to wear men's clothes because they didn't sell women's clothes for that kind of work. And the sparks would get down through your collar. They'd go on down to your chest and they burned.
Moore lived in San Francisco with her sister during the war, along with many other shipyard workers, because housing was so scarce in the East Bay. Richmond's population jumped from 20,000 people before the war to 100,000 in 1945. Moore boarded a ferry every day from the Embarcadero.
It took us right to the yard where we worked. And I worked in shipyard 3 for Henry J. Kaiser.
Kaiser was an American industrialist who founded the Richmond shipyards. He is known as the father of America's modern shipbuilding. A few years ago, a man contacted Moore to thank her for saving his life. He told her that his military unit had been fighting against the Japanese at Okinawa Island and ran out of supplies, weapons, and options. The next day, a whole fleet of US-made supply ships, warships, and troop carriers came over the horizon. They were saved.
And he said, "You women built those ships." And he said, "We most certainly would have died because the Japanese, they were fierce fighters."
Richmond's Rosies came from all parts of the U.S. and all walks of life to contribute to the war effort. Catherine Morrison, or Kay, moved to Richmond with her husband from Chico, California.
So we packed up what belongings we had, which wasn't much, threw them in the rumble seat of a 35 Plymouth, and away we headed for Richmond. Naturally, because here was Kaiser's four shipyards.
At first, Morrison couldn't get work. A big sign at the Union Hall in San Francisco, where new workers came to find employment, read, "No women or blacks."
In January of 1943, the sign was gone. I thought, oh, that's good news. And I marched myself up to the window, and I told the man I wanted to go to work.
The union man told Morrison she was going to be a welder.
What the heck is a welder?
But soon, Morrison wasn't just an ordinary welder. She was a journeyman.
That means I was certified. By the way, can I add that it takes 5 years for a welder now to be certified? We did it in months.
Morrison recalled the work clothes she had to wear in the shipyard, down to the most intricate details.
I wore leathers, heavy leathers, and they were coveralls. And there was a jacket, same, and also leather gloves that came up to your elbow. And I wore boots, high-top boots.
Once a sleepy Californian town, Richmond was a hive of activity during the war, and so were the shipyards.
It seemed like the shipyard was a town in itself.
The Rosies weren't just shipbuilders, but also designers. Marion Suzet was a draftsman, part of an all-female team. They drew the technical plans for the ships and were tasked with constantly making them more efficient.
There were always constant changes being made for a better ship, a better way of building them, and so that's what our job was to do.
Her most memorable days in the shipyard were when she and the other draftsmen were released from work to go and watch a ship launch.
So it floated. We knew it was success.
All of the Rosies at the visitor center say they were humbled by all the recognition. Here's Marion Suzet again.
We never expected to be recognized. Never. And so this, all of this has come as a nice surprise in our late ages.
And here's Agnes Moore.
I'm amazed at how strongly people feel. We were just doing what we thought was what we should do, and also what was needed to be done.
In April 2014, after 12 years of letter writing by Marion Suzet's sister Phyllis and another Rosie from Pennsylvania, March 21st was officially recognized as Rosie the Riveter Day. The Rosies were formally acknowledged for their work by former Vice President Joe Biden, and six Rosies were invited to spend a week in D.C., where they got to tour the White House. Marion Suzet points to a picture.
Here we are in Nancy Pelosi's office, so you know we made it. So,
For the Tales of Two Cities podcast, I'm Lizzie Roberts. The music today, Jocker's Dance Orchestra, comes from Free Music Archive.
The Richmond Museum is bridging the gap between the past and present by celebrating 100 years of World War I history. We caught up with the Richmond Museum's director to learn more.
So we're here at the Richmond Museum with Ms. Melinda McCrary. Talk to me a little bit about how the museum has been preparing for this occasion.
We have a new exhibit opening commemorating the centennial of the United States' involvement in World War I. And I actually started planning this exhibit when I was an intern here in the costume collection, because my position here started as a volunteer, and I ran across these lovely World War I uniforms when I was looking at the costume collection. And there were so many of them, and they were in such wonderful condition that I thought, you know, this is really interesting. And then as I learned more about the collection and learned about the breadth of the materials that we have related to World War I, I knew that we should do an exhibit. And my team of volunteers and I have been working and researching in our collection and in other archives for about a year now.
Thinking about museums, how did you guys go about deciding what could make it into the World War I exhibit?
When you're looking for ways to, to decide what gets into the exhibit is what's going to be most relevant to the community. So we are looking for things that are visually appealing, have a significant impact, and have a relationship to a local person.
So the World War I exhibit is really special to Richmond, especially now. Tell us why.
April 6, 1917 was an important day because the United States formally declared war against Germany. I believe the beginning of World War I was really the beginning of the home front of both World War I and World War II. And a lot of the institutions that made Richmond so successful during World War II, the groundwork was actually laid for them during World War I. For example, there was 800 members of the Red Cross, Richmond chapter of Red Cross, by the end of World War I. And Richmond was a very small town in 1917. So having 800 members parading through the street, you know, like as a raising money for the Red Cross, that's actually quite impressive. The United States government asked the citizens to basically donate and raise money for the war effort. And every city was in the United States was given a price or a, you know, we're hoping you raise this much. Well, Richmond exceeded their money that they were supposed to raise in all four of those drives. So again, just a huge sense of patriotism was born and, you know, developed during World War I that I believe made Richmond super successful during World War II.
If folks are going to want to come out to the museums, what are they going to see here?
They are going to see a variety of types of artifacts and photographs and documents related to World War I. We are very proud to have several gas masks on display that are part of our collection. And one is related to Dr. Abbott. Dr. Abbott was the county coroner. He was had the first hospital in Point Richmond. He was a state medical officer, very prominent in our community. community. And we have a whole suite of artifacts related to him and his time working in Bonn, France at the hospital base number 47.
How do artifacts help people in particular to relive history and learn about history in a different way?
In this day where technology is so accessible and people can get an image or of pretty much anything they want to within a few seconds, a few strokes of the key, the authentic has taken on a really a new meaning to us. You know, to have the opportunity to see the actual item, being able to experience the authentic is something that is becoming less and less frequent. So the museum is providing this unique experience in, you know, being able to connect to the authentic object, you know, experience the authentic in a way that when we're bombarded with images and reproductions, and some of them have truth and some of them don't, it's nice to give the opportunity to experience something that's unique and actually authentic to the time.
In a sense, it's basically like having a piece of living history that you can interact with. Obviously, you might not be able to touch it, but you can definitely see it up close and personal, see how it was made, see its wear and tear.
It bridges the gap to the past. You know, it brings the past alive for somebody who might not have that, you know, a love of history, or it might be something that seems so foreign to them. Well, when the real authentic object is right in front of you, the museum provides an opportunity to bridge that gap, that, you know, that gap of time. And, you know, local history is really important just in general, because it shows people that extraordinary things have happened in a place, and it inspires people to accomplish extraordinary things in their own lives.
Well, that's it for this episode of The Tales of Two Cities. We hope you enjoyed all the history. If you like what you just heard, comment on SoundCloud or write us on Facebook by looking up our websites, Oakland North and Richmond Confidential. Or you can even tweet us. We're at North Oakland Now and at RI Confidential.
Our producer this week is Angeline Burnaby, and our music is by Kevin McLeod. You can listen to our podcast on oaklandnorth.net, richmondconfidential.org, and on SoundCloud. I'm Rachel Lloyd.
And I'm Ryan Lindsay.
Thanks for listening to the Tales of Two Cities podcast.